You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin, and here with a remarkable story of Central Kentucky and Native American history is Kentucky Humanities Executive Director Bill Goodman.
Nearly 200 years ago, on a plot of land in Scott County, Kentucky, Native American men and boys, a few whites, and freed and enslaved African Americans came together in an experimental community called Great Crossings. The Choctaw Academy was to become the home to the first federal Indian school in America. At the time, only one other school in the United States was funded by the federal government, West Point. Penn State historian Christina Snyder is the author of Great Crossings, Indians, Settlers, and Slaves in the Age of Jackson. Professor Snyder writes that the Choctaws hoped that establishing a school for their children outside of their homelands would signal that they were civilized and deserved a place in the nation.
Over the course of the lifetime of the school, which is 1825 to 1848, over 600 different Indian boys and men went to this school from 17 different tribal nations. So it was by far the largest and most diverse Indian school in antebellum America. I think it's important today because it's a place that really shows us the diversity of antebellum America and brings different kinds of stories together, because these were people who had very different ways of life. They spoke different languages. They couldn't communicate necessarily except in English. And so even among the native population, this was a really diverse place. But also in Scott County, they met local whites. They went to church if they so chose. They went into Georgetown to go shopping. Some of them snuck into taverns, you know, and got into trouble. And there were also enslaved people at the academy. There were both free and enslaved African Americans in Great Crossings. And some of them were actually covertly educated at the school. And so what I think it represents is the coming together of really different people in antebellum America and the ways in which they clashed, but also tried to cooperate and think about a future together.
Snyder said that from the very beginning, the Academy's future was uncertain. The election of the nation's seventh president had a negative effect on the survival of the school.
The election of Andrew Jackson really changed Indian policy significantly to what we call removal policy. And most Americans probably know the Cherokee Trail of Tears, and they associate that with the Cherokee Nation. But that was actually a blanket policy that applied to all Native peoples of the East. So all told, it forcibly removed about 100,000 Native Americans from their homelands to Indian Territory, which was west of the Mississippi. And so in that kind of new context, it became harder and harder to see how Choctaw Academy was going to fit into the national fabric. You know, lots of white policymakers asked, well, what's the point of educating Native people if they're going to be forcibly removed anyway? So you go from kind of a policy of assimilation to separation. And Native peoples became frustrated as well, because they felt that the quality of education they received declined over time because of the removal policy. And because of that, and also because Native people are footing the bill for this, they're actually paying about 90% of the money that maintained the academy, they ultimately decided to use that power of the purse, remove the money, and establish their own school systems in Indian Territory, which is what's now Oklahoma. So essentially what they do is they take some of the lessons they learned at Choctaw Academy, some of the positive things, but also many of the critiques that they had, and they use them to forge new public school systems in their own nations.
5 years ago, Georgetown ophthalmologist Dr. William Chip Richardson was looking for some land in Scott County. The land he purchased included the remnants of the original Choctaw Academy, built in 1825 by Kentucky landowner and a vice president of the United States, Richard Mentor Johnson.
When I purchased it, the apical roof beam, which was tied into the chimney on one end and then resting on a wall on the other, had a pretty tremendous sag in it. The building had somewhere, probably in the mid-1900s, had an asphalt shingle, you know, placed on it to try to save it from, you know, water penetration. And about 3 months after I closed the deal on the farmland, I was graciously rewarded with that apical beam collapsing. And like a wishbone, you know, it either was going to push out on the front wall or the roof rafters were going to push out on the southern wall. And we ended up losing a pretty large part of the southern wall. And at that point, I realized, you know, oh my gosh, you know, this needs to be saved. And I had a lot of connections within my practice, people to talk to, people with the Heritage Council and whatnot, and they all were great and gave me great advice. But, you know, as you know, water penetration is like the enemy for any structure of any kind. And that became my first priority, was to try to find a way to stabilize the structure. I mean, early on, you know, it's mostly stone and it's probably not, you know, a panic, but I knew that ultimately we needed to get a roof over it in a pretty short time. The next steps that I took after we kind of reached a point where the Heritage Council could not formulate a preservation easement was to try to find out who would make good natural collaborators. And I tried, you know, social funding, you know, group funding, like what can we do with GoFundMe? And my GoFundMe page at the time, you know, earned about, you know, maybe $1,000 or $2,000. And I thought, okay, this isn't going to get me where I need to go for a pole barn structure to put over the whole thing. And so I started reaching out to the Choctaw Nation, you know, first of all, with a phone call and then some emails.
Was it difficult learning who to call and what number to reach them?
So that's a great question. So they have a great website. The Choctaw Foundation, C-H-A-H-T-A Foundation, which is their charitable arm, has a great website. And on there, a list of the people, including their executive director. And I reached out to him directly and found him to be a very willing partner, because it is well taught within the nation that the Choctaw Academy was a very integral part of not only Choctaw survival as a nation, but in terms of them getting the necessary Western education to become competitive as European expansion was taking place.
Today, a number of partners are coming together to restore the Choctaw Academy. The Georgetown Scott County Museum, Kentucky Humanities, filmmaker Michael Breeding, and RCI, an International Construction Trade Association with 3,600 members, has adopted the project and will encourage its members to donate money, materials, and expertise during the restoration. Richardson has high hopes for the future of the land and the school.
I would say that the resounding opinion for most preservationists is, wouldn't it be cool to kind of put the school back together and at least, you know, build the foundations of the buildings that are gone so people could see where they were, you know, kind of reference the old photographs that we have and just kind of stand there. Because when you stand on that farm and you kind of look over the hillside and you imagine, you know, the thousands of acres that the Johnsons owned at the time, you can still imagine that today. You know, it's not encumbered by a lot of modern utilities and whatnot. I mean, you can stand on that farm and really be taken back in time. And when you open the door to the Choctaw Academy and you kind of look at the first floor and you go into the basement where they did a lot of their cooking on a Franklin stove, I mean, it's a real time warp. But I would say that there's a lot of educational opportunity there, things that look at to kind of reflect upon diversity and the way cultures were colliding in the early 1800s, how the Indian Removal Act, you know, had a negative impact on the Native Americans, you know, assimilation, you know, versus removal. There's a lot of teachings there. And most importantly, I mean, it doesn't end with the Native Americans. As many don't know, R.M. Johnson was de facto married to an African-American. It was actually his father's slave that was left to him when his father passed. And Julia Chin, as a quote-unquote second lady, as an African-American essentially running a plantation, there's so much to learn there about how African-Americans were embraced or shunned, you know, during the period of 1820 when I think a lot of Kentuckians and European immigrants were still trying to figure out how the African-Americans fit into the big pictures in terms of race relations. The Julia Chin story is a whole, you know, story by itself. And her slave quarters is still partially standing there on the farm, on the parcel just to the north of the Choctaw Academy dormitory, which I own. And it'd be nice to see it all come together again. So when I'm old and gray, what I would like to see is honestly the whole thing become a historic landmark. If that's also what the Native American tribes wish for this as well, I really think they should be in the driver's seat in terms of helping me make decisions for the future of the place. But it would be nice to see it as a historic landmark. It would be nice to see those foundations of the original school buildings and maybe even build the classroom back. I think the foundation is still there. And look over that hill and literally see the Choctaw Academy, you know, at least as much as we can afford to have it in its original glory, and have people come and enjoy it and learn those things that I mentioned before. That would be a great place for me. I mean, there's enough farmland there. It's not like those folks are going to be intrusive. I think it's something that we're obligated to share.
Even though the Academy's fate was sealed by the historical events of the late 1840s, author and historian Christina Snyder found a compelling story replete with diverse and compelling characters.
And it's not a story that you see a lot in antebellum history. That is, we don't often see really rich histories that do involve white, black, and Native Americans all at the same time, coexisting in the same space. And I think the thing that surprised me the most when I started researching was the richness of the records. You know, oftentimes, especially when you look at Native American or African American history before the Civil War, it's incredibly difficult to get good records, you know, and people can often emerge as kind of flat or stereotypical because you don't have that richness of information. And that's not the case here because we have so many Native people and some African Americans who wrote a lot and whose letters survived and who come off as funny or, you know, sad or sarcastic, even, that they're extremely rich voices in that historical record. So that's really what surprised me the most. And that's still what I love about the book. And I think that's what people respond to.
For Kentucky Humanities and Eastern Standard, I'm Bill Goodman. When they are home, when they are home, when they are. When they are, ho, 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 hey, oh, hey, oh, ya, ya, ya.
A modern-day member of the Choctaw Nation has set out to correct the record on a Cherokee legend. We're joined by Devin Mahisua, a Choctaw historian and writer, and a previous editor of the American Indian Quarterly. Dr. Mahisua is a professor in international cultural understanding at the University of Kansas. She maintains a particular focus on stereotypes and misrepresentations of Native American peoples, customs, and beliefs. And she'll be on campus at EKU on November 15th for a Chautauqua series talk about her book, Ned Christie, The Creation of an Outlaw and a Cherokee Hero. And we look forward to that, and thank you for this preview, Dr. Mahisua.
Well, thank you for asking.
And first, if you could, a little bit of background for us to orient us. Tell us about your research. What sorts of information did you look at to inform your writing of this book?
Well, Ned Christie, or Ned Ewade, which means son of Watt, he did not leave behind any diaries, no interviews. In fact, most of his family did not leave behind any kind of oral testimonies either. So I looked at hundreds and hundreds of newspaper articles. I looked through all the Cherokee House and Senate records, voting records. I looked through just an incredible amount of Wild West literature. Where was Ned in all of this?
And am I correct that the address you'll be giving when you're visiting EKU on the 15th is titled Ned Christie, Untruths and Their Consequences?
Yes.
I can't imagine anything more relevant to now, to present times, and our struggles to distinguish fact from fiction. But you're referencing a time frame of more than a century ago. Is this the more things change, the more they stay the same?
You know, people needed to sell copies. So they had to come up with the most exciting headlines, sometimes the most ridiculous stories. But on top of that, they needed to please their readership. And their readership, you know, was primarily white males who very much admired masculine men. But what we really needed during that time period were to have some very evil bad guys, and the bigger and the badder, the better, because that made the white lawmen who would eventually kill them or arrest them and ultimately hang them, makes them look even bigger and better and more skilled at what they were doing. So this is the time period in the late 1800s. We start seeing the rise of real interest in masculinity, muscular men, tall men. This is why many of the movies that we see, the Westerns, you know, even when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, all these rugged, very distinctive actors, well, like Chuck Connors, Lee Van Cleef, Clint Eastwood, all of these people. And then the bad guys they come up against, you know, they seem to be almost equal to them.
Let's back up a little bit and have you tell us, who was Ned Christie?
Well, Ned Christie was a Cherokee Catua. And Catuas were and are traditionalist Cherokees. That is, they adhered to culture. They very stringently wanted to make sure that they kept their tribal resources, their lands. They were not at all proponents of really intermarriage with whites. They continued to speak Cherokee, to practice their ceremonies. And so Ned Christie, in 1887, he was serving on the National Council. And this was when Chief Dennis Bushyhead was the leader. And in 1887, it was in May, Dan Maples, who was a U.S. Deputy Marshal, came to the outskirts of Tahlequah. And he was really primarily interested in fishing and maybe doing some turkey hunting. And maybe while he was there to investigate the burgeoning whiskey problem. But while he was there in Tahlequah, this was the same time that Ned happened to be in Tahlequah as well, somebody shot and killed Dan Maples under the cover of darkness and escaped. And nobody saw it. Nobody knew who did it. To make a long story short, there were a variety of men who were in town at the same time that Ned was, who had long histories of violent behavior. And any one of them could have been the culprit. But the blame fell on Ned Christie through a series of unfortunate events. And so for the next 5 years of his life, he tried to evade posses. And it was in November of 1892 that a very large posse came to his house at Wahalo, which is outside of Tahlequah, and blew his house up with dynamite. And as he was running outside the front door, they opened fire and shot and killed him.
Now, prior to the shooting of Maples, had Ned Christie been in trouble with the law?
Yes. What we have to keep in mind is post-Civil War Indian Territory was very violent. Murders, rapes, you know, theft, whiskey running, it was very common, and everybody carried a weapon, you know, even kids. You know, would carry a knife. So Ned really lived in this time period, and he was brought up in this time period. So he had been accused of killing another man several years before that. And in fact, the family admits that, yeah, he probably did, because they were out shooting pigeons. And one individual kept trying to get Ned to drink with him, and Ned didn't want to drink. So the guy called him the son of a bitch, and he took that as an insult to his mother. And as the story goes, he shot him and killed him. But he was found not guilty when he went to trial.
Hold that thought. After the break, more of our conversation with Devin Mahisua about her book, Ned Christie, The Creation of an Outlaw and a Cherokee Hero, and Lexington author Joe Anthony on A Wounded Snake, his historical novel about life in the Lexington of the Jim Crow era as seen through the eyes of the publisher of the Lexington Standard, a newspaper covering the city's African-American community. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on the WEKU network of stations.